back to Feeling Seen, the podcast that talks about the movies that make us feel seen. Today, I am talking to Rebecca Hunt. Her debut feature film project, experience, video biography, it is called Beba. And Niani Scott at RogerEbert.com called the film the, quote, coming-of-age story that Black American children have been waiting for. A documentary that encompasses every step of reclamation of an American bloodline. End quote. Rebecca is the star, the director, the writer, the literally everything else you can think of. Rebecca Hunt, tell me all the things that you did to make Beba real as we begin this conversation. I don't want to shortchange all the things that it took to make this project.
Thank you so much, Jordan. I appreciate this intro. So I actually wrote, directed, and produced the film. I produced it alongside Sophia Gault, who's also the only other producer on the film.
Mm-hmm. As we see you in Beba, you are, I believe, in your mid-20s, and now I think you're in your early 30s. So this has been a years-long endeavor. How much of that, over that course of time, was spent like concentratedly working on this?
Yeah, it took about 8 years to make this film, and the actual visuals of the film end when I'm in my mid-20s, mm-hmm. but I didn't finish the film until like a year ago. So it's meta, I know.
Yeah. How now, are you like the band who's been playing their greatest hits for a really long time now, and they're like, I don't want to hear that song again for a while? Are you like, I don't want to hear about me for a while after this? Or are you like, I'm feeling really enlivened on me right about now?
I'm not going to lie. I feel very proud of myself and of my team, and my dreams are coming true right now. So it's unbelievable. That's incredible. That's it's amazing. But but also it's a whole lot of me. You know, the film is cringe for me. But, you know, the whole point of to make this film for me was to connect with people. And so the fact that I can, you know, so many people are resonating with the film throughout this, but the festival circuit, which ended with Tribeca. Well, actually, it didn't end with Tribeca. It'll still go to other festivals. But, you know, it's also being released now in theaters on June 24th. So I feel like it's amazing to have had all of the conversations I've had around the film and to connect with people and have people share their stories with me. And that's awesome.
You are now entering my universe. I am the lens, the subject, and the authority.
Tell us, how do you summarize what Beba is? Because, I mean, it's a documentary, but it's something else. Like, I just want people to have a good sense of what it is you've made with this. And I feel like I can't adequately present that.
Yeah, I am not the best pitcher for this film, which is really funny. I'm so happy that it's gotten so far because I'm not the best pitcher for it. Mm. But I would just say that it is a existential coming of age film, and that it is very honest.
It is. We follow you through, a process of digging into the relationships in your, like, the closest relationships in your life, like with your family and how you grew up and how your family grew up and how that influenced how you were raised and how the antecedents of your immediate family, like, you know, parents, grandparents, great grandparents, the places they're from, Venezuela, Dominican Republic, how those past lives influence you in the present. And there's visual references to those times that existed before you and you participating in sort of like rituals of your cultures, and there's poetry. And so it's very much like experience was the best way to say it, because I didn't want to limit it with another word that might categorically box it in.
I think that makes sense. Yeah, like I'm excavating my closest relationship, I'm excavating some of my demons, I'm excavating some of my heartbreaks, some of my pain, some of my joys, the things that are important to me, the things I love, all of that.
Okay, well, now for our dual purposes here, it is, of course, talked about the current work and then to talk about work that has been resonant for you and characters that have been resonant for you. And you gave me like a whole little list of them. And what I you know, the fun of that is kind of pulling, finding the threads to pull through. A couple of them were Frances Ha, Matilda, Lady Bird, Poetic Justice. And what I enjoyed about all of those is that those are all titular role characters, not just stars of the movie. Like, everybody that is a star of every movie. These are titular role characters, which kind of lets us know that the whole universe of this movie in sort of a particular, maybe an idiosyncratic way, is going to be organized around the name of the person who is on the title, who the title on the box. And your film itself, you're the titular role in that as well. Tell me about making yourself the title character and feeling like feeling a sense of identity within other title characters that are sort of like as sort of bigger than life in the way that Frances, Lady Bird, and Matilda all are as well.
And Justice.
And Justice, yes.
My hair is still an ode to her now. Yeah, that's a really interesting question. I think that, you know, this was a hard question to answer because I've never really felt like there was any one character that fully, like, made me feel seen. And if you notice, a lot of the majority of those films have come out like in the past 10 years, not even. I think, you know, one of the things that's interesting about the titular characters that I thought about it as you were saying is I come from a schooling of women not being the protagonists of their own lives. And I'm just starting to think now that maybe that's part of the catharsis of it, is that I really have fought to be the main character of my life.
That's right. Now, do you feel like when you started working on Beba, was that a process you were cognizant of? Or is that something that came later at this point or in the process of making the movie? Were you fighting that fight when you were like, I'm going to make a movie about my life and put my name on it?
Well, I just thought about that when you were asking about, you know, these sort of like characters whose names are in the titles. But when I was creating Beba from the get-go, I wanted it to help me build a life and a community that I could be proud of. But when I look at these other characters like Frances Ha, when I'm thinking back to Matilda, or Lady Bird, they're just characters in which I felt fully complex characters, like full three-dimensional, even five-dimensional, because we're not really three. I mean, we see in three-dimensional, but our dimensions are pretty infinite, you know?
I like that.
Yeah. And so it made sense that, you know, the way that their beings were captured, it's like, okay, yeah, you are the name of this capturing of you. And I mean, I guess Beba is like that in a sense. It's like, yeah, here's the capturing of this existential experience. And here's a very innocent, I mean, innocent, that's not the word I wanted to use. I don't even like the notion of innocence, really. Like, it's something that I find really complex and kind of weird. But, and that's a completely different thing. But I mean, I meant to say intimate. You know, here's this intimate portrayal. We're going to give you her intimate pet name.
Yeah. I won't, like, you're like, that's a whole other thing. But I'm curious about what is your sort of reflexive derision with the word innocence? I'm curious about that.
I just find it to be something that can sometimes be imposed onto people. And somebody who's, you know, came up with a Catholic upbringing and, like, what innocence meant in Catholic households, specifically for women, is just something that I think is limiting.
Thank you for that. That's exactly the kind of thing I wanted to know. So thank you for telling me. I think with those characters as well, with another one you cited was Mookie from Do the Right Thing, which is Spike Lee's character in that. And with Frances, Matilda, Lady Bird, and you cited she's got to have it, Nola Darling. Like, they're all these characters, even with Mookie, he's our sort of point of view character. He interjects into Do the Right Thing, and he's sort of our guide on this journey through the film. And they're all characters around which the universe of the film, and again, to a degree, that's all protagonists, but I feel like these are particularly specific characters where the universe of the film has to kind of bend around them, because they are sort of, they're out of step with the norms of people around them of what they would consider normal. Like, Lady Bird is kind of swimming against the current. Matilda is young and magical and doesn't make any sense to the family that she was born into. And Justice in Poetic Justice is sort of finding her way after this great loss. And can she love again? And Janet Jackson being just one of the most magnetic people that's ever existed of all time. Like, I wanted to hear about sort of these characters that are inherently against the grain of sort of what is around them, but also exceptionally compelling. And that's almost a part of why they seem to sort of buck up against the norms, because they're extraordinary. Like, picking these extraordinary characters within extraordinary circumstances, fighting against normalcy to a degree in some ways.
Yeah, totally. I totally feel that. And even in their like subtlety, like, France, like, I think about Frances Ha. Mm-hmm. I just showed it to my niece recently. We watched Lady Bird, and then we watched Frances Ha.
Great double. Great programming double right there.
I was like, maybe we should watch Frances Ha first, and then Lady Bird's in order of them coming out. You know, mm-hmm. And just, like, I'm showing you all of Greta Gerwig's work, because I'm a huge fan.
Mm-hmm.
But then I was like, you know what? No, because she's 16, so she'll really enjoy seeing Lady Bird as a 16-year-old. And then,
yeah, let's lock her in. Let's get her in with that foothold.
Yeah, exactly. And then, you know, because, you know, I don't know how much she'll understand Frances Ha quite yet. But anyway, even with Frances, like, I remember watching it on screen, Frances Ha, mm-hmm. when it came out, and I was, like, a recent college graduate. And I was just like, oh, my God, like, I identify with you so much. And then watching it, like, every couple years after that, and still, mm-hmm. even now, when I showed it to my niece, being mm-hmm. like, oh, my God, I still identify with, like, the kind of person you probably became, Frances. Like, yeah. You know what I mean? Like,
you can see her life after the movie.
I'm going to Paris for 2 days.
What?
Why so short?
I have a meeting with Colleen on Monday.
Wait, I thought you were poor.
I'm going to use this credit card I got in the mail.
That's not smart. That's what they want. They want to keep you in debt.
I know that. I see documentaries.
Well, good for you, kid. I lived there for like a year.
You never told me that.
Yep. I was there when Serge Gainsbourg died. It's a crazy time.
Weren't you like 8?
Yeah. It was the end of Euro Disco.
I have so much to do. I think I'll probably read Proust, because sometimes it's good to do what you're supposed to do when you're supposed to do it.
Proust is pretty heavy.
Yeah, but it's worth it, I hear.
No, I meant the book, Carrying It on the Plane.
I should probably learn French first and then read it in French. Undateable.
Watching her navigate life on screen
mm-hmm.
as this character where she's just like, okay, I'm going to go to Paris for a weekend and I'm going to mm-hmm. max out my credit card. There's like a self-possession there, or just, yes. You know, even though it was not like the best decision of all time, mm-hmm. it transcends judgment. There's mm-hmm. something really powerful about that. There's something really powerful about a young woman being self-possessed in that way and us being able to see it. You know, even her being like, her moving to Washington Heights.
Oh, right.
When you are in a sort of like artsy liberal bubble in New York, it is mm-hmm. a big deal to move to Washington Heights. Because okay. especially if all of your friends are based in like the East Village in Brooklyn.
Uh-huh.
At that age, that feels like the biggest move you'll ever make. And I remember uh-huh. watching it when I was, you know, younger than whatever age Frances Ha was in mm-hmm. the film. I think she's like 27. And I was probably like 24 watching the film and like, wow, she really did her thing, you know? And so it's deep. Frances Ha is another, well, I think it's another sort of existential coming of age story. Hmm. A young 27-year-old woman who is living in New York and mm-hmm. is a dancer, kind of, but like doesn't really dance that much, as she said. And she's just trying to figure it out, you know?
Yeah.
She's just trying to figure out what life is and how mm-hmm. she wants to live it.
And what is it you said, like, obviously with Lady Bird and you're showing, you know, people this works of Greta Gerwig. What is it about what Greta Gerwig imbues into her characters or her stories that makes them, like, consistently appealing for you?
Well, I think that the universe are so profound, the nuance, the self-possession, mm-hmm. the imperfection, mm-hmm. and in a way, the defiance and, like, the power. Mm-hmm. But it's, like, not defiant because they want to be. Like, mm-hmm. a lot of us are just defiant because, like, the world says that. It's, like, actually, no, we're just, like, these weirdos who don't, you know? It's, like, yeah. we're not even trying to be anything other than what we're trying to be than ourselves. And for some reason, people are reading that as defiant, but it's actually mm-hmm. just, like, authentic. I don't know. I love her. Clearly.
Okay. Christine?
Lady Bird.
Is that your given name?
Yeah.
Why is it in quote?
Well, I gave it to myself. It's given to me by me.
Okay. Take it away, Lady Bird.
Everybody says don't. Everybody says don't. Everybody says don't. It isn't right. Don't. It isn't nice. Everybody says don't. Everybody
is that
says
something
don't.
That you felt like you have been saddled with as well? The sense of, like, oh, Rebecca, she's just always pushing back. She's always being defiant, and you're like, I'm just being myself. Like, is that something that has been resonant with you as well?
Well, in different ways. I don't think defiant in this film. I think people thought it was defiant that I made a film about myself, which I guess is defiant in a way. Yeah. But I also feel like, you know, there are other things that the film has been called, and I'm just like, okay, like, if that's mm-hmm. how you feel, cool. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't feel that way, but if you feel that way, then I think that that's cool. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, like, if we normalize whatever that is, I'm down. Mm-hmm. You know,
and reading interviews with you that I could find, there was, you know, every so often, like, the notion, like, the concept of you as a filmmaker would come up, like, that's your profession. You would, each time you'd remark upon, like, yeah, like, I'm like, film, this is what I want to do. This is my dream. Like, there was just a sort of emphatic punctuation on, like, this is exactly what I want to do, what I'm kind of meant to do. And I wondered, when did film start becoming a part of your life where you really started gravitating toward it and sort of living inside of it in a way that you wanted to bring that into your own life and make things to put back out into the world as well?
Yeah, well, I made my first film when I was 15. Like, I went to a film camp when I was 15 years old, and I made mm-hmm. my first short, which is actually in the film for a little bit. In Beba, it's included. And then I knew I wanted to be an artist, and I always loved film, but it just felt something so, like, something that was so unrealistic and unapproachable, especially when I went to college with a lot of, like, movie star kids. Mm. And it even felt that much more far away when I got there, and it's interestingly enough. And then, you know, when I was trying to figure out, again, shortly after graduating, what is, you know, what do I love the most? What do I resonate yeah. with the most? What are, you know, what is something that I feel confident in that I know? Mm-hmm. And also something that I know will reach my communities and mm-hmm. as many communities as possible. And film kind of incorporates all of these things, and it allows you to collaborate with so many amazing people, and mm-hmm. and it is a very accessible art form.
Yeah.
And so that kind of helped guide me when I, you know, was having a conversation with my producer, with my now producer of Beba film, but then we were just, you know, friends in college. Mm-hmm. And we were just, like, talking about the world and our own dreams and stuff. Mm-hmm. And you know, this came up.
And I, you know, watching, obviously, a thing that becomes, like, starkly clear immediately is that, you know, a big part of your story is that you grew up in a one-bedroom apartment on the Upper West Side with a family of five. You were all in that unit together. And so I wondered, was your experience of film at a young and developing age, was that shared with your family, since you're all very much in one place? Like, were these movies you were watching, things like Poetic Justice and things like Do the Right Thing, like, especially the older ones, when you would have, I would imagine, around the age might have been home when you saw them, was that things that you were experiencing with your family?
Yes. My father mm-hmm. used to bring a movie home every Friday. And I never, our house was so small that they couldn't really be PG or PG-13 about me. Like, I saw Pulp Fiction when it came out when I was 5.
Yeah.
So, but that's a huge part of me being a filmmaker now, because mm-hmm. my palette back then was, you know, like, Disney movies were not my favorite movies when I was 5.
Right.
Maybe one of, like, if you asked me of my top 3, I would name, like, a Guy Ritchie film. Like, I'm not even 10 years old yet, and my favorite films are Pulp Fiction, Lock, Stock, and 2 Smoking Barrels, and Disney's Aladdin.
Yeah. My Disney princess is Jasmine, and my favorite director is Guy Ritchie.
Literally, though. So I feel like that added to it. That added to it. Yeah. Being able to see these other worlds on a regular basis. And it was also something that was really, it was so special to me, because that was a moment where everyone in my family could get along in this small apartment and kind of like escape into these different worlds. Mm-hmm. So it also meant a lot in that way. Or I would, you know, go to the $3 movie theater with my mom that was like on 34th Street at the time. I don't remember where that one was. But there was also like a $5 one on like 6 blocks from my house. So, you know, these were rituals, and these were very important rituals that were happening in my life. And so what I sort of connected with film and cinema are some of the most profound and beautiful moments in my life.
We were an arguing household. Like, the fights happened out in the open. It wasn't like, I'm gonna go talk to your mother. It was, we're gonna fight at the dinner table, and then everybody's gonna be involved in the fight. And, you know, if it started about me or my sister, it would always like crescendo to this point where then my parents would just start fighting, and me and Riley would look at each other and be like, are you still mad? And she'd be like, no. And we would just be like, all right, we're gonna eat dinner. And they're like off on some other thing about their marriage. We didn't do a ton of stuff as a family. Like, you know, we had sports that the parents took us to, and like, mom made dad work in the yard. Yeah. But we watched movies together.
Yeah.
We would watch movies together, and it was great, shitty action movies. It was whatever Steven Seagal made that week. And Jean-Claude Van Damme, and like, those movies are so dear to me now, because those were like, that could have happened at the dinner table, but it was like, well, it's movie night. So dad would lay down in front of the TV with his candy on his chest, and we would sit up on the couch. And like, that was the most harmonious times I can think of with us all together, actually sharing an experience in our house, was when we were watching movies.
Literally same, Jordan. Most harmonious moments. Like, we didn't go on family trips. Friday night was movie night.
Yeah, I think I remember one trip we went on. It was like for my birthday, we went to Seattle and went to a Mariners game because I was really into baseball at the time. But like, we didn't, the trips we took were to go to like softball trips for the weekend for me or my sister. Other than that, it was like they were living separate lives, my parents at home, or we were like sitting together and watching a movie.
Yeah, same. The only trip we went on, I think, that I can remember was when my dad took us to Disney World for my 7th birthday. And I just remember all of us coming back from that trip like, ooh, this is probably never going to happen.
Well, that was a one and done.
Yeah.
Glad we went all the way to Disney World.
Yeah, exactly. Glad we went to Disney World.
I love that you mentioned Pulp Fiction specifically, because that was, I think, because I could always watch, my first movie memory is Hellraiser when I was like probably around 3 or 5. But then like the only movie my parents were ever hesitant to let me watch was Pulp Fiction. And I think it was because of the gimp scene and they didn't really know how to broach that. But then I remember like I'd wanted to watch it. I was asking my mom if I could watch it. And she finally, because they would do Sunday grocery shopping and they would be gone for a couple hours. And when I could finally stay home by myself, I remember one time my mom was like, you can watch Pulp Fiction while we're gone. If you have any questions about it, you're welcome to ask when we get back. Otherwise, go for it. And I was oh yeah, it was a triumphant.
How old are you?
10. I was 10.
Amazing. Amazing.
We're going to take a quick break, but we will be right back with more Rebecca Hunt. And afterward, I will have one quick thing before I go about the movie on everybody's lips on Twitter, Barbie.
Hal Laplin here with breaking news on a revolutionary form of entertainment, professional wrestling. For more, we go to our correspondent, Danielle Radford.
Professional wrestling is the craze that's sweeping the nation, featuring fisticuffs,
at colorful costumes.
But who can help us make sense of this world of body slams? Lindsay Kelk has the answer.
Sources tell us of an amazing podcast called Tights and Fights, filled with discussions of the absurdity of professional wrestling, plus all the sincerity and hilarity that you could shake a stick at.
Listen to the Tights and Fights podcast every week.
Find it on Maximum Fun or wherever you get your podcasts.
And your old-timey radio.
Hey there, I'm Ellen Weatherford.
And I'm Christian Weatherford.
And we've got big feelings about animals that we just gotta share.
On Just the Zoo of Us, your new favorite animal review podcast, we're here to critically evaluate how each animal excels and how it doesn't, rating them out of 10 on their effectiveness, ingenuity, and aesthetics.
Guest experts give you their takes informed by actual, real-life experiences studying and working with very cool animals like sharks, cheetahs, and sea turtles.
It's a field trip to the zoo for your ears.
So if you or your kids have ever wondered if a pigeon can count, why sloths move so slow, or how a spider sees the world, find out with us every Wednesday on Just the Zoo of Us in its natural habitat on MaximumFun.org.
Listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Feeling Seen. I'm here talking with filmmaker Rebecca Hunt, whose debut feature, Beba, is a kind of documentary self-portrait of her and her family. She feels most seen by characters like Francis from 2012's Francis Ha and Justice from the 1993 movie Poetic Justice, which is what we are going to talk about a little bit right now. Tell me about Poetic Justice. Did you see that when you were young, or was that when you came into later? You mentioned your hair is even still a living reference to Janet as Justice.
Yeah. I think I saw it when I was really, really young, but I don't remember, like, because I had cousins who were like, yeah, you've seen it. But then I saw it again when I was 13.
Okay.
And I was like, oh my God, Justice.
Now you understand just why my head's not bowed. I don't have to shout or jump about or have to talk real loud. When you see me passing, it ought to make you proud. I say, it's the click of my heels, the bend of my hair, the palm of my hand, the need for my care. I'm a woman phenomenally.
But I was also like 13, so like obviously like I was just like, she's so cool.
She is so cool. Yeah,
exactly. And I still feel that way. And Janet Jackson is the coolest ever. And then like Maya Angelou's in it, Tupac, and like all of these legends.
Regina King, I'm pretty sure, is in that.
Yeah, it's like, yeah, it's, I mean, legends.
The 90s let Black cinema stars be so many more things that I feel like we are only now returning to a time. We're only just like getting to a time where there is a multitude of blackness on screen that feels like it gets close. The way Janet Jackson could be the star that she should have been, the way, like, the whole panoply of Wayans output.
Spike Lee, John Singleton.
Yep.
I mean, in terms of, like, Ice Cube.
Wesley Snipes being one of the biggest fucking stars in the country. Eddie Murphy.
Well, Blade levels. But Blade, wait, was Blade 2000s?
98. Blade is a year before The Matrix, 90s. Ladies and gentlemen, giving you Matrix style.
Yes.
I will stand on a rooftop and scream about Blade as a precursor to the possibility of The Matrix.
Me too. I love the 90s in general because I was born in 1990. So, but there is this sense that I feel of, you know, there were films like, you know, there was like the Spice Girls, and then there was, then there was Matilda, and Poetic Justice, and like, you know, all of these, and Mookie, and Nola Darling from Do the Right, Nola Darling is, I was going to say Nola Darling from Do the Right Thing, but it's Nola Darling from She's Gotta Have It, Mookie, The Right Thing. Sorry, Spike, I love you so much. but there, like, Nola Darling is a revolutionary character.
Yes.
And so I feel like, but then I feel like when I was growing up, sort of, especially like as a teenager and a preteen, I didn't see many films where I was reflected at all. And I think maybe that's why, you know, one of my cousins was like, you got to watch Poetic Justice. You kind of remind me of Justice sometimes.
It's
like, you know, I think in the 2000s, I don't really get the sense that there were any, and I could be totally wrong.
No, I think what we have in the 2000s acutely is like a nadir of culture here in the States. I love this stuff. And the further you go into it, the more it's like, wow, you have to dig so deep to find the meaning in all this stuff because it is buried underneath the layers of nightmare superficial bullshit that is keeping us prisoner at that time. So it makes it like a fascinating exercise to like unearth that stuff.
Yeah, I mean, in that sense, I feel like then it would make sense that I've, you know, it's like Frances Ha, Lady Bird. Mm-hmm. Well, Frances Ha came out in, what, 2012?
2012. I'm getting the confirmation of 2012. Thank you for producer Marissa.
So, yeah, then in that sense, it does make sense. But it does make sense in general. It's also just like where we're at with cinema, where we're at with politics, yeah, where we're at with the world right now. There's so many dope directors. Female directors, directors of color, you know, just like there's more diversity now. So there's mm-hmm. more diversity in story. And like there could be, you know, there's always room for much, much more. But I do think that there is something happening that's been happening for a bit in terms mm-hmm. of like nuance and complexity. Because I think about like Terrence Nance's film, An Oversimplification of Her Beauty, which changed my life. That also came out in 2012. Mm. You know, and that was a personal documentary.
Well, I mean, and nobody can anticipate the world that their film is going to arrive in because films don't get made in 15 minutes. Like, even a movie that gets made in a timely fashion, it's like it could be like a 2-year process. And that's like if things are going well. And then you started making Beba in a different, in a, you know, a world that certainly reflects realities that were always there, but things that have come gushing forth that were not made normal and mainstream as acceptable ways of behaving. Like we're in a maelstrom right now, and that maelstrom has gotten bigger and bigger and bigger over the course of you making this thing. And so like you start your journey as filmmaker, and then you work on this, and then this finally makes it into the world. Does the world available to you as a filmmaker now, how does it feel different than the world available to you as a filmmaker when you started making Beba?
Well, I think that I can answer that in a lot of different ways. But like when I started making Beba and throughout the process of making Beba, like I had three jobs at all, like three jobs plus this film.
Right. Yeah.
So like at any given time, I was working at two different restaurants. And I was personal assisting. I had a fellowship at one point. So it was just like my fellowship. I could only work at one restaurant now. And yep. I still had Beba. And Beba was a constant throughout this entire process. So when I think about like, and also, you know, when I think about creating in general, a lot of that shit has to be quiet for me to like feel free and feel, especially with a film like Beba. But I think in general in my creative process, like, there's a lot of things that I have to quiet to sort of begin to access the place I want to be within the creative process, which is mm-hmm. this place that feels like limitless and transcendent and expansive. Mm-hmm. And I was able to do that. And that has to do with me.
Yeah.
And so I don't know if this is answering your question at all, but now I feel like the access that I have, you know, when Tom Powers called me to tell us that we got into that we would have our world premiere at Toronto International Film Festival, my response to him while I was crying and like literally just like vomiting and crying yeah. was literally
screaming, crying, throwing up, but literally.
Yeah. Was, I just thought that this would play at a community theater in Detroit somewhere.
Yeah.
You know, and so I think the access now, it's like the film is being distributed by Neon. We have international distribution with Onyx Collective. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, it's had a really amazing festival run. And some of the conversations I'm having with different people in the industry, I do think that there is, people are trying to create space for this stuff. And mm-hmm. clearly, you know, something's happening because this personal experimental documentary is being distributed. And like, you know what I mean? So
from the studio that brought you Parasite comes Beba.
Yeah. Well, Neon is also just like so special like that. They're incredible. Yeah. That was my, they were my like North Star. That was my dream. I was like, I'm going to shoot for the moon, which is neon, and I'll land in the stars, which is like Detroit, like, you know, community cinema. And then I was able to do both because I actually was able to go to the Free Film Festival in Detroit, which was incredible, and play at a community cinema, Cinema Detroit. Yeah. Shout out to Cinema Detroit. You did. That was really special, that whole process. Like, Toronto, neon, like, it's fucking dope.
Not bad. Not bad. Rebecca, congratulations.
Yeah. So much
My way that I will like come around to the end of this is another little character set you mentioned was like you cited the big hitters of Star Wars, Leia, Luke, Han, Darth Vader,
all of them.
And I wanted to mention sort of the Darth aspect of it, mm-hmm. in the sense of like the villain edit, like, you know, you have like, you know, perhaps a passing, perhaps an intense alignment with Darth Vader at points. And then here you are responsible for a work bearing your own name that features you. And you're like, how honest am I going to be about who I was at this time, at this time, at this time? And I wanted to hear from you about like making space for like a villain edit of yourself, perhaps in some ways, being like, there are the, like, I remember like it just hit me in the chest when you talk about moving back to the apartment where your family still lives and being like, I tried not to think about the fact that I took the bed that my mom sleeps in and now she's on the couch. And like, I wanted to talk about embracing that honesty of a portrayal of oneself that's really hard, knowing that it's going to be out there forever, and being like, I'm part of this edit, I'm part of this coming together, and I want this here.
Well, yeah, I think that is the, I mean, definitely I was a part of the edit and a part of the writing and a part of the choosing, mm-hmm. and a part of the filming, you know?
Yep.
It was so, like, the bigger picture was to connect with people on an authentic level, to start having conversations. Because the conversations that were happening around me, whether it was on the tension of in New York or in this country, mm-hmm. or even within my family or with my friends, they weren't authentic. Like they weren't, those conversations didn't feel like there was space for connection or mm-hmm. space for authenticity.
Mm-hmm.
And in order to sort of throw something out there that would hopefully bring my life more authenticity, mm-hmm. and more honest connection, mm-hmm. I had to show that.
Mm-hmm.
And also there was something deep inside of me that understood that, like, all of us, like, that's the thing. It's like, why are we all lying?
Yeah.
We know that all of us have this. It's not even that, like, it's not that deep.
Yeah, yeah.
All of us have these really complex sides to us. Like, that's why when you said, who are the characters that you identify with? Mm-hmm. I identify with Princess Leia, Han Solo, Darth Vader, like, and Luke Skywalker all mm-hmm. at the same time.
I am all the elements of character archetype. God damn it.
Equally. But I think most human beings, like, archetypes can't really exist in the real world because that's why they're archetypes.
Mm-hmm.
But as human beings, like, there's things that I've done that have been really bad and really mm-hmm. shitty and horrible. Some of them are shown in the film.
Mm-hmm.
There's things that I've done that are amazing, that I'm so proud of myself for, that really sort of have built the compass of, like, my moral code. And mm-hmm. there's things that I've done that I am disgusted by. And there's mm-hmm. things that I've done that I am so secretly confident and profoundly proud of. And it's just all of those exist at the same time at all times, because none of us are perfect. We're literally, we are made of infinite mass from mm-hmm. like a multi-universes. We don't even know what's happening.
We have
no idea where we are. We're on a floating rock in the middle of like the multi-universe of vast nothingness. Like, obviously all of these things are going to exist. So, like, why not just stop lying?
Yeah.
You know, and just be more free and access more deeply our capacity to love and be loved.
Rebecca, that is the best possible way I could have hoped to close this conversation with you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jordan. Your energy is amazing, Jordan. I love
Thank you. Listen, it's an honor for me.
Works slower. Sometimes, and I like, there's certain things that I want to come back to, but I'm just like, we don't have time. Like, I want to listen to things you said.
When you're ready for a bonus episode about the resonance of 90s cinema, we are ready to have you back. This is, it's a privilege that I get to have these conversations with people who make stuff and put things out into the world. And Rebecca, congratulations on being not only the main character, but the titular character today and going forward.
Thank you for having me. I loved it.
Thank you again to Rebecca Hunt. Beba started screening in New York and LA this past weekend, and it will be expanding throughout the country. So check it out. I have to believe it's kind of unlike anything else you've seen this year. It is a unique viewing experience. So get out there, and as we say, always support independent film, support small films, support new filmmakers. This is your responsibility as a movie fan. And now, we've got one quick thing before we go. We've talked about her a lot on today's episode, pretty fair amount. Greta Gerwig, the writer and director of such hits as the aforementioned Frances Ha, Lady Bird, Little Women, and now, Barbie. The Barbie movie. And you know, people can say their things about IP. They can say their things about, like, Hollywood cashing in on titles, turning toys into movies. I, more than most anyone, will stump for the Transformers franchise, so I certainly don't have a problem with any of that. But Barbie, you know, it's, you kind of think about it, it strains credulity. You're like, how is this possible? How are we going to make a movie with any semblance of credibility out of Barbie? But again, I implore you to remember, this is a Greta Gerwig film. You know that Greta Gerwig did not go into that studio and present a pitch that was just like boilerplate, we're gonna put Barbie in a bunch of fits and we'll send her to Malibu. Like, there's got to be more here. I can't, why the hell would Greta Gerwig pitch on Barbie unless she was like, I have got a fucking idea, you guys. And she has done too right by us with characters like those titular roles, like Lady Bird, like Frances, like the whole gang in Little Women. Saoirse Ronan would not continue to work with Greta Gerwig if she was not capable of giving you the Barbie prestige picture you didn't think was possible. And this cast, it's every time there's an announcement about Barbie, and every time the BTS photos have started rolling out, because it looks like they're shooting in like Venice, and there are photos now of Margot Robbie and Ryan Gosling, her Ken doll, in neon lycra spandex, pink, yellow, orange, blue, roller skating around. Excuse me, rollerblading. Fact check: rollerblading around. Every time you see a new image or hear a piece of casting, it just feels like it's actually just one long Twitter thread where people keep replying to each other with just absurd scenarios, and that it's not actually real. Like, it's not actually true. Like, this, there isn't a movie with Academy Award nominee Margot Robbie playing Barbie and Ryan Gosling as her Ken with America Ferrera there and Kate McKinnon and Emma Mackey, the one and only actress who I will accept your shitty jokes about every white woman looking like Margot Robbie. I'm sorry, Margot Robbie looks like Margot Robbie, and Emma Mackey looks like Margot Robbie. That's the doppelganger situation. Issa Rae is going to be there. Michael Cera is going to be there. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. Emerald Fennell, writer and director of Promising Young Woman, coming back to Margot Robbie in a reunion. She's going to appear in the movie. See, it's just a fantasy casting Twitter thread. But no, friends, it's real. Barbie's real. It's in production right now. Greta Gerwig is, as she does, dressing on theme to direct the movie. There have been BTS photos of her as well in a soft pink jumpsuit with matching shoes, because Greta Gerwig's a bad bitch and she wears costumes to set. This movie's coming in 2023. Hopefully we never stop getting a steady stream of images and costumes leading all the way up to the release. Give me actually every minute of this movie in still frames before it comes out, and I will still feast on every minute when I see it live action, because I think it's going to change our lives. I think if this comes out in the middle of 2023, well, look at that. Best Picture nominee potential 2024. Barbie. Greta Gerwig's Barbie. How big of a fuck you would that be to the Academy that, like, doesn't nominate women as directors? We're going to get Best Director, though, to Greta Gerwig. It wasn't going to be for Little Women, but it's going to be for Barbie. Let's keep the dream alive. Let's keep hoping for this better world. So that's that. That's that on Barbie for now. There will be more quick things about this, I'm sure. And that is our show, in fact. You can follow us on Twitter at FeelingScenePod, or you can send us an email at FeelingScene@MaximumFun.org. If you want to follow me, I am Jor Crew on Twitter. That's JORCRU. Our theme music is by Andrew Eben. The show is produced by Marissa Flaxbart. Our senior producers are Kevin Ferguson and Laura Swisher, and this is a production of Maximum Fun.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.